passage. Let me thank you so much for the invitation to come and to be a part of this study. I've looked forward to this for a long time and the opportunity to work with Bubba again. We were trying to mention to him at breakfast this morning. He and I worked together in Mount Pleasant on a youth weekend, if I remember right. And that's been a long time ago. In fact, it was so long ago that both of us, our hair was actually a lot darker then than it is this morning. Hopefully, I know you're hoping right now that I am going to cover the humanity of Jesus, because the prospect of me preaching to you twice tonight is actually more of a punishment to you than it would be to me. Perhaps the most compelling paradox that has ever captured the attention of mankind is God becoming man. The incarnation, the union of deity and humanity into a single person is undescribable, unexplainable, unfathomable. That no matter how much we unwrap its truths, no matter how deeply we dig into it, no matter how much effort we give to it, you still walk away just shaking your heads in amazement at God becoming man. G. Campbell Morgan, in his writing, said he was God-man, not God indwelling a man, of such there have been many, not a man deified, of such there have been none, save in the midst of pagan systems of thought, but God and man combining in one personality the two natures. Two natures melded together inseparably and yet in a sense unmixed. A mysterious union of undiminished deity and authentic humanity. That in a person you have one who is co-equal, co-eternal, co-existent with the Father. Jesus of Nazareth is both fully God and at the same time fully man. Not just a good man who lived as God would have him to live, and not some mechanical, sterile, metallic God who knows nothing of humanity except perhaps by way of theory, but rather God locating his infinite nature into a single human body. And Paul talks of some of that here in Philippians chapter 2, beginning in verse 5. He writes, "Have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant, and being made in the likeness of men, being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross." Paul says, understand that Jesus always and unalterably has existed as God. There has never been a time when that was not the case, that he has all of the rights and the privileges and the authority of deity. He is the exact nature and the substance of God. And yet Paul also adds here that Jesus did not perceive his right to stay in heaven and to enjoy the blessings and the privileges and the benefits that came with that realm, but instead of selfishly clutching to those things, he willingly emptied himself to save us. Not emptying himself of any portion of his deity. Whatever the incarnation involves, we can rest assured that it was not a situation where Jesus exchanged deity for humanity. He did not become less God in order to become more man. But instead, the ultimate expression of love and humility. He left the glories of heaven in order, Paul says, to take on the form of a servant, to walk in our skin, if you will. Not as a ghost or a phantom, not just as a reasonable facsimile of a human being, but as a man. In Jesus, God came down from heaven to walk among us. Jesus had a particular height and weight. His hair was of a particular color and a certain texture. He spoke a particular language. He experienced and he felt what you and I experience and feel. When he cut himself, he bled. When he was sad, he wept. When he was hungry, his stomach gnawed at him like it does ours. When he was cold, he shivered. When he was hot, he sweated. And when his heart stopped, he died. In fact, so complete was Jesus' identification with us that most people never were able to see beyond that. They never saw him as anything other than one of them. They never saw past his humanity, even though, as we'll study this week, numerous claims were made by Jesus. An abundance of evidence was presented to the contrary, that in Jesus he was a man, but much, much more than a man. And of course, during his ministry, there were a wide array of opinions about his identity, and those wide array of opinions about Jesus continue even into our own day. You remember in Matthew chapter 16, Jesus questioned them, who do people say that the Son of Man is? And they gave the response, well, you know, some say he's John the Baptizer, some say you're Elijah or Jeremiah. And then, of course, Jesus says, but who do you say that I am? And Peter responds, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. In first century Palestine, as people looked at Jesus, the bulk of them, at the very best, saw him as the reincarnation of the baptizer, or Elijah, or Jeremiah, or one of the other prophets. In other words, they saw him as a remarkable man of God. But they didn't see him as God. He was just a man. And even today, is that not the common perspective that people have of Jesus? They can't see beyond his humanity. He's a good teacher. He's a marvelous moral instructor. He is a popular religious leader who dies for a cause. And again, they can't see past his humanity. And in our series of studies this week, we're going to focus our attention not on what other people said about Jesus, not the opinions that they had or who they thought Jesus to be, but we're going to look at some of the pointed declarations that Jesus makes about himself, declarations that are recorded for us in the Gospel of John. And if you'll look over at the Gospel of John, notice, if you will, chapter 20. In Romans, or excuse me, not Romans, John chapter 20, John chapter 20 and verse 30, John chapter 20 and verse 30, John provides for us the thesis statement here of his gospel. What is he trying to accomplish? What's his purpose? And John says in chapter 20 and verse 30, therefore many other signs Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. John says, look, I'm not writing this to provide you with entertainment. I'm not writing this to quench your curiosity. I'm not even writing this to provide you with information about Jesus. John says, I'm writing this book to help create in your heart and in your mind a belief in Jesus as the Christ. And John does that in some unique ways in his gospel account. One way that he does that is that John includes in his gospel seven, he refers to them as signs. We would describe them as miracles. Five of the seven are unique to John's gospel. In John, we also hear from seven different spokesmen who have arrived at a settled conviction in regard to Jesus as the Christ, the Son of God. And another way that John looks to bring belief into our hearts and minds is through 23 incidents in his gospel where Jesus employs a statement that from a Jewish standpoint would have been dripping with meaning. I am. And in seven of those instances, Jesus couples that phrase, I am, with an important and a meaningful metaphor. When Jesus uses this simple phrase to describe himself, in the Jewish mind, there would have been an immediate connection to Moses' encounter with God at the burning bush. You remember it was there in Exodus chapter 3 and verse 14 that God identifies himself as the I am who I am. It was a name in which God proclaims himself to be the eternal, self-sufficient, self-determining, self-sustaining one. And as difficult as it is for us to wrap our minds around that truth, what God was telling Moses and what he tells us in that statement is he just is. He's never been more and he will never be less. That our God never needs refueling, he never grows tired, he doesn't experience mood swings or personality changes, that the pantry is always full and therefore his divine resources are constant. Never once does God say, I once was, nor does he ever say, I will be. He says, I am. Right here, right now, always. And thus, when Jesus uses that designation to declare his identity, and especially when he adds a powerful metaphor to it, I am the bread of life, I am the resurrection and the life, I am the light of the world, I am the good shepherd, it is either a statement of absolute blasphemy or is a declaration of his true identity, that he is God in the form of man. When Muslims and when the majority of Jews speak of Jesus, they respect him as a great prophet, as a marvelous teacher, but no Muslim could ever imagine Muhammad claiming to be Allah any more than a Jew could imagine Moses claiming to be Yahweh. The phrase in the Greek that's recorded in John's Gospel is ego I me. Not just I am, but I am. And what's significant about it is it's the precise wording of Exodus chapter 3 and verse 14 in the Septuagint. Now, the Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Old Testament. And so, even though Jesus would have spoken it in Aramaic, when John records it, he conveys the same idea that Jesus, when he uses that statement, he is making a radical claim in regard to his connection with God. And it is that one aspect that stands among many of the greatest problems that people had with Jesus in the first century, and that people continue to have today. That he's more than a man. He is God. And I don't think that there's any way for us in 21st century America to imagine the stumbling block that would have been presented before those people who heard him in the first century to hear a poor, uneducated carpenter from a small, obscure village in Galilee to begin his sentences and make declarations, I am. And yet Jesus confidently uses that statement more than 20 times in John's Gospel, and often it lands him in trouble. Because the Jews understood what Jesus was saying. They knew the meaning that was conveyed in those simple words. Jesus was making a claim to be deity. And in John chapter 10 and verse 30, they understand. You are making yourself out to be God. Now look back at John chapter 18. And let's just talk for a few moments here about Jesus of Nazareth. That's how he's identified here in John chapter 18. I'll be reading out of the New American Standard through our study. In John chapter 18, beginning in verse 1, when Jesus had spoken these words, he went forth with his disciples over the ravine of the Kidron, where there was a garden in which he entered with his disciples. Now Judas also was betraying him, knew the place, for Jesus had often met there with his disciples. Judas then, having received the Roman cohort and officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, came there with lanterns and torches and weapons. So Jesus, knowing all the things that were coming upon him, went forth and said to them, Who do you seek? They said to him, Jesus the Nazarene. He said to them, I am. The New American Standard adds the word he. It's in italics. It's been added. I am. And Judas, who was betraying him, was standing there with him. So when he said to them, I am, they drew back and fell to the ground. Therefore, he again asked them, whom do you seek? And they said, Jesus the Nazarene. Jesus answered, I told you that I am. So if you seek me, let these go their way to fulfill the words which he spoke. Of those whom you have given me, I lost not one. Now, as we think about Jesus of Nazareth, as we think about Jesus from his humanity, we often stress the fact that Jesus is the Son of God, that he is the only begotten of the Father, that he is the Messiah, that he is the King. And of course, all of those things are absolutely true. But seldom do we pause to think about the challenge that's presented in Jesus' roots. Think about it from the standpoint that if you were going to plan for human redemption and that plan would involve incarnation, how would you go about doing that? Well, one way that you could do that is that you could find a good man and you could find a good woman and that married couple could have a child, but all that would produce is another human being who was born into a conducively spiritual environment. He would be all humanity and he would be no deity. Or you could have him come totally separated from human beings altogether. He could come directly from heaven like an angel. He would therefore be clearly supernatural. He would be able to remain pristine and pure in the defiled environment of sinful humanity. The problem with that is that he's all deity and he's no humanity. The third possibility would be for you to place the Spirit of Christ into an existing human body. And some people believe that. The Gnostics certainly did. That you would find a good man, a Jewish man that had all of the proper lineage, and you would place the Spirit of Jesus inside of that man. But the problem with that is that you sort of have a schizophrenic, don't you? You've got two personalities in the same body. Or you could do what God did. You could choose a virgin, and through the unique event of a miraculous conception, you could give birth to a child who was both fully human and fully divine. For Jesus to be human, he has to enter the world by the same means that we do, and that is through a mother. And yet at the same time, for him to be deity, he cannot enter through the same means as you and I did, and that is through the means of an earthly father. And so what God's choice was, that his son, would be incarnated, would be the result of a woman who is pregnant, but who has no earthly father involved. And so, we have that part of the question dealt with. But how would you bring the Son of God to earth? How would you incarnate God in human flesh? Well, surely he would be born of prominent religious stock, wouldn't he? He would be born of a royal family, and that birth would take place in a luxurious palace. And in addition to that, this family would receive VIP treatment by the world. It would be like the royals today when there's a birth of a child. I mean, the world stops when they have a baby. But that's not how God does it. Instead, at a time when young couples would be looking forward to the celebration of their marriage and starting a home of their own, Mary and Joseph are thrust into a situation that would not only have been very painful, but would have been extremely complicated. Look at Matthew's gospel. Look at Matthew chapter 1. Matthew chapter 1. As the New Testament opens, what we know as the Gospel of Matthew, Matthew doesn't start with declarations of Jesus' deity. Now, John will certainly do that from the opening verses of his gospel, but Matthew doesn't. Instead, the way Matthew introduces Jesus is in verse 1, the record of the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. And what follows is Matthew chronicling 42 generations that validate and establish the royal bloodline of Jesus. But even though he comes from royal roots, he's got a clear connection to Abraham and David, his bloodline does not lead to palatial splendor. Instead, it leads to a poor couple with an unbelievable story. Look at verse 18. Now, the birth of Jesus Christ was as follows. When his mother Mary had been betrothed to Joseph, before they came together, she was found to be with child by the Holy Spirit. And Joseph, her husband, being a righteous man and not wanting to disgrace her, planned to send her away secretly. When he had considered this, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream, saying, Joseph, son of David, do not be afraid to take Mary as your wife, for the child who has been conceived in her is of the Holy Spirit. She will bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. Now all this took place to fulfill what was spoken by the Lord through the prophet. Behold, the virgin shall be with child and shall bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which translated means God with us. And Joseph awoke from his sleep and did as the angel of the Lord commanded him, and took Mary as his wife, but kept her a virgin until she gave birth to a son, and he called his name Jesus. Can you imagine what that conversation would have been like between Joseph and Mary as she relates the visit of the angel in Luke chapter 1 and verse 26 through 34? How she's trying to explain her pregnancy, that she's not been with anybody else, that this pregnancy comes as a result of the Holy Spirit, and how Joseph must have just imagined that. You're insane. That's what you expect me to believe? That you weren't with somebody else? That the child that you're carrying is of the Holy Spirit? Remember, there's not a lot of precedent for this. And how unimaginable that explanation would have seemed in Joseph's mind, to the extent that very clearly here in Matthew chapter 18, he doesn't believe it, at least not initially. Imagine the pain and the suffering that Joseph must have experienced when, as he's looking forward, having been betrothed to Mary, looking forward to their future together, and now she is carrying a child that is not hers, and his world and their relationship seems to be shattered. Now, in our day, when there are more than a million teenage girls who become pregnant every year out of wedlock, Mary's predicament seems almost irrelevant to us. But Mary doesn't live in 21st century America. She lives in first century Palestine. She lives in a religious community that numbered around 200 people. And so even though she has been chosen to be the bearer of the most wonderful gift that was ever given to humanity, Mary will, for the rest of her life, bear the stigma of being an immoral sinner. And it's not just going to be Mary who will be subject to the stares and the whispers of other people. When Joseph agrees to take her into his home as his wife, this was, in a sense, an admission that the child is his, that he's a fornicator. Can you imagine? You're God. You're planning the redemption of the entire world. And you are going to place that plan on the shoulders of a couple of rural teenagers who experience one of the most impressive miracles ever performed, and yet do so willingly with all of the scandal that is attached to it. Jesus, you'll remember, is born in Bethlehem. For fear of Herod, he and his parents flee into Egypt until they eventually return to their hometown of Nazareth. A place so small and so insignificant that the Talmud doesn't even mention it among 63 other towns of Galilee that are listed there. Galilee is a rather prominent province, but it's located the furthest away from Jerusalem, and therefore it is perceived as being filled with uneducated and culturally backward people. The Galileans were the hicks. They were the country bumpkins of the first century world, and they were the butt of ethnic jokes. Because they pronounced Hebrew so poorly, they were not asked to read from the Torah when they were outside of their own province. They spoke the same language, Aramaic, but they spoke it in such a careless and unrefined way that it was a telltale sign of where you were from. You remember when Peter is standing in the courtyard of Caiaphas and he's warming himself and he's denying that he knows anything about Jesus, it's his Galilean accent that gives him away. And Jesus, surely as he grew up in that town, would have also had a distinct rural northern accent. He's from Galilee. From the perspective of the Jewish religious powers in Jerusalem, Galilee is about the most unlikely place from which a Messiah would come. Look at go to the Gospel of John again. Gospel of John, chapter 7. Look at John chapter 7. Notice verse 42. Excuse me, verse 52. Well, let's back up. Let's go back to verse 49. But this crowd, which does not know the law, is accursed. Nicodemus, who came to him before, being one of them, said to them, "Our law does not judge a man unless it first hears from him and knows what he is doing, does it?" They answered him, the Pharisees, the religious leaders, "You are not also from Galilee, are you? Search and see that no prophet..." The idea here is the prophet that Moses had talked about back in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 18 and verse 15, that no prophet arises out of Galilee. Now, we didn't have any choice as to when we would be born, where we would be born, to whom we would be born, and under what circumstances we would be born. But Jesus did. And yet, even though he comes from royal roots, even though there is a direct link to David, he is born of a poor Jewish couple. He's raised in a backward, disrespected corner of Palestine. Nathanael would ask the question in John chapter 1 and verse 46, "Can any good come out of Nazareth?" Now, we're going to obviously fast forward through his growing up years. And so in the blink of an eye, now we're at Jesus and he's around 30 years old. C.S. Lewis in his book, Mere Christianity, said, "Among these Jews, there suddenly turns up a man who goes about talking as if he is God. He says he has always existed. Among the pantheists, anyone might say that he was a part of God or one with God. There would be nothing very odd about it. But this man, since he is a Jew, cannot mean that kind of God. God in their language meant the being outside the world who has made it and was infinitely different from anything else. And when you have grasped that, you will see that what this man said, quite simply, was the most shocking thing that has ever been uttered by human lips." What would we have noticed had we lived in Jesus' day? Look at Mark chapter 8. Mark chapter 8. Notice the first three verses. Mark chapter 8, beginning in verse 1. If we had lived in Jesus' day, I think one of the things we would have noticed in his rise to prominence was the fact that not only is he a remarkable man, but he had a magnetic personality. We find in those days, beginning in verse 1, Mark 8 in verse 1, "In those days when there was again a large crowd and they had nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples and said to them, 'I feel compassion for the people because they have remained with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them away hungry to their homes, they will faint on the way, and some of them have come from a great distance.'" Can you imagine any speaker today that you would listen to for 3 straight days without going home? Now, I love listening to Russ and to Bubba. Sorry, fellas. Come lunchtime, I'm out. Think about what Jesus' preaching must have been like. That you willingly stay for 3 days and you're not worried about your stomach gnawing at you. We come on Sunday mornings, we listen to human beings who preach, and usually, let's hear, we start about 10, so about, what, 1:15, you're usually finished? And somewhere in the middle of that sermon, I had breakfast, but I'm a little hungry. Sure wish Bubba would wrap this thing up so we can go to lunch. The preaching of Jesus was so riveting that these people were out there with him for 3 days and they ignored the growls of their stomachs. What was that like? That you hung on every word that he said. When we think of Jesus, we think of transparency and openness as a man. He's moved by compassion for a leper in Mark chapter 1 and verse 41. He feels anger and sadness over the hardness of human hearts in Mark 3 and verse 5. He feels overwhelming sorrow over an unrepentant Jerusalem in Matthew chapter 23. He's brought to amazement by the unbelief of those in his own hometown who knew him best. In Mark 6 and verse 6, he marvels at the faith of a Roman centurion. In Matthew 8 and verse 10, he's exuberant over 70 who returned, who had been sent out to preach. In Luke chapter 10, he feels overwhelming anguish in the Garden of Gethsemane, and on at least three occasions, he openly weeps in front of his disciples with no attempt to hide it. There's not a lot of people of prominence who make themselves that vulnerable as what Jesus did. If you had been in the presence of Jesus, you would have seen encouragement like nobody else. In a world where people typically praise themselves, a world just like our own, Jesus is constantly praising other people. He remarks at times about the greatness of their faith. He refers to Nathanael in John chapter 1 in verse 47 as a man in whom there is no guile. He describes John the Baptizer as being the greatest of those born among women in Matthew 11 in verse 11. He takes a vacillating Simon Bar-Jonah and he looks at that man in John 1 in verse 42 and he sees Peter, a rock. And in John 12, when Mary gives an extravagant gift of devotion that brings criticism from the disciples who see it as a waste of their resources, Jesus not only defends her, but he declares that the story of her generosity would be told forever. In fact, it is one of the few accounts that we find in all four of the Gospels. The man Jesus was someone who was patient those that others would have seen as distractions. And so as he's traveling, and there are a couple of blind beggars, one of them being named Bartimaeus, is crying out to him to heal them so that they could see, he stops and he takes care of him and the man that was with him. He attended wedding feasts that lasted for days. Think about that. We complain when there's not something to eat at the reception while the pictures are being taken. Jesus stayed days at a wedding feast. He stopped to speak to and to heal a hemorrhaging woman who had touched his cloak in Matthew chapter 9. When his own disciples wanted to send the 5,000 home so they could get something to eat, Jesus fed them in John chapter 6. There's the man who's born blind in John chapter 9, a topic of theological discussion for his disciples, a source of annoyance for the religious leaders. But for Jesus, he's a man who is in need of saving. Jesus accepted, I think, everyone's invitation to dinner. I couldn't think of one where he refused the invitation. And those invitations resulted in a diversity of followers, but it also earned them the reputation of being a friend of sinners, a reputation of himself being a drunkard and a glutton. Some of the most moving scenes of love and devotion involve people who are the down and outers, people who possess less than stellar reputations. Most people, except obviously for the religious leaders, enjoyed being in the presence of Jesus. There they found hope and encouragement and truth. Jesus had a way of connecting with people, unlike anybody else. There's no one that I could think of in my lifetime. Now there's some that I think of in that way, but there's nobody in my mind that gets even remotely close to Jesus in terms of personality. That there was just an overwhelming kindness, an overt love, a genuine compassion, along with evident strength and a winsome character. I think one man wisely put it this way. He said, if Jesus had never lived, we would not have been able to invent him. How successful are we at being that? Because that's the call, isn't it? In Romans chapter 8, in verse 28 and 29, that's who we are to be. We're to be conformed to the image of God's Son. He's the example that we're to be following. He is the one that we are to be imitating. Jesus shows us what it truly means to be made in the image of God. That's who he intended for us to be. Now, Jesus was a remarkable man, but he was much more than a man, wasn't he? Look at Matthew chapter 7. In Matthew chapter 7, at the conclusion of what may well be the greatest sermon that was ever preached, Jesus, when he concludes his teaching that we know of as the Sermon on the Mount, notice the response of the people to his teaching. Verse 28, when Jesus had finished these words, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one having authority and not as their scribes. They'd never heard someone proclaim such insightful words of wisdom as Jesus, to supply them with such a powerful and demanding description of what true righteousness is about, and never heard such a clear condemnation of self-righteousness. And what stands out, what Matthew points out about the Sermon on the Mount, is the authority with which Jesus teaches. Where the scribes tended to quote other people to lend authority to their teaching, Jesus would quote from the Word of God, and then he himself would speak as though he was the final authority on truth. He speaks directly, he speaks with love, he speaks without hesitation, he speaks without consultation. And the people are astonished. Jesus never preached at previously arranged engagements like this one. He never preached to packed stadiums. There was not some PR team that went out ahead of time to drum up support and to invite people, billboards that would announce his impending arrival. Instead, he and his small band of followers simply wandered from town to town, having no permanent base of operations, no headquarters, no tangible property that they owned, no officers of their organization, with the exception that Judas, a crook, was the treasurer. Jesus, the man, was a masterful teacher. But what I find so impressive about Jesus is that he teaches some of the most profound truths through the simplest of stories. To teach us about prayer, he tells the story of a woman who wears down an unjust judge. He tells us of a king who enters into an ill-advised war to teach us kindness and compassion. He tells a story of a man who was mugged and who was left for dead, to describe to us the joy that heaven feels over a sinner who repents. He tells a story of a woman who loses a coin. She looks through her entire home in order to find it. That rather than just talking about the boundless love of God for the lost, he instead tells the story of a heartsick father whose eyes are focused on the horizon every day in hopes that he will see his wayward son coming toward him. Instead of going into detail as to why we find different responses to the message of the gospel, he instead tells a story of a farmer who goes out and he sows different seed that falls on different kinds of soil. And rather than teaching some deep theological discussion about grace, he tells a story about a farmer who goes out and he hires workers throughout the day. And then when the end of the day comes, he rewards every single one of them with the same amount of pay. Whether you worked 12 hours or whether you worked one. The power of Jesus in his teaching must have been incredibly compelling. We read the words, but imagine being in front of Jesus and hearing his teaching. We also see it in his wonder-working power as well, don't we? If we had stood among the crowds, certainly we would witness some supernatural power that was at work at him, and it would be working in different ways. Sometimes Jesus would simply speak the words. Other times he would reach out and touch them. At other times he would heal or perform a miracle across great distances, and yet never once does Jesus ever advertise his power. That's interesting, isn't it, in light of today's faith healers? Hey, come see a miracle. Jesus never did that. In fact, in Mark's gospel alone, there are 7 times where he specifically tells the person healed, don't tell anybody. His miracles propelled him into the public spotlight, but never once does Jesus seek in the public attention that was attached to them. In fact, what Jesus didn't want them to see the signs. What he wanted them to see was what the signs pointed to in regard to his identity. If all you saw was a miracle, in Jesus' mind, you missed the real message of what was being communicated. John chapter 1 and verse 18, John begins his gospel with this statement: "No one has seen God at any time. The only begotten God who is in the bosom of the Father, he has explained him." Where men tend to define God by what he's not. He is invisible. He is infinite. He is immortal. Jesus of Nazareth is God with human skin on. He's a scaled down model of God, if you will, that enables us to see and to better view the characteristics of our Creator. He is the great I am in human flesh. And because of that, we can see who God is. And we're able to see what we were meant to be. We see everything we should want to be, everything we should desire to be. And when we look at Jesus in the Gospels, Jesus of Nazareth reminds us of just how far we missed the target. I wonder if we had lived in the first century world, if we would have been able to do what most folks in that day could not, and that is to overcome the obstacle of his ordinariness to the extent that we could fully embrace his extraordinariness. For we either believe the real Jesus to be the Son of Man and the Son of God, the one who demonstrates by both his words and his works who he actually is, or we don't. And our eternal destiny hinges on that single decision. Who is Jesus of Nazareth? Thank you so much for your time at this point.